Joining me today on the Power of Showing Up podcast is the wonderful Maggie Dent. Commonly known as the Queen of Common Sense, Maggie Dent has become one of Australia's absolute favourite parenting authors and educators. She has a particular interest in the early years, adolescence, as well as resilience, and is an undisputed boy champion. Maggie is the author of 9 major books, including the best-selling Mothering Our Boys and her 2020 release From Boys to Men. She hosts the ABC podcast Parental as Anything and in 2021 released a book of the same name. In May this year, Maggie released her first book about girls, girlhood, raising our little girls to be healthy, happy and heard. Maggie is dedicated to quietly changing lives in our families and communities. She is the mother of 4 sons and a grandmother to 7. She joins us now on The Power of Showing Up to discuss the power of lighthouses and to explain how to talk to teens. Maggie Dent, welcome.
Thank you so much, Georgie. I'm really looking forward to this chat.
As am I, because you and I have chatted many times over the years and you have been an absolute lifesaver to me as a parent. And I really mean that, because your knowledge, your experience and your absolute passion for precious young people is just so extensive, and you really have been a guiding light to so many parents and educators. And I think I was thinking about this morning, I think it's primarily due to your common sense, as I touched on, but also your candor. You're so quick to talk about your own experiences, the good and the bad and the ugly. And I think as a parent or an educator, it's so important to be authentic and to be realistic.
I think that real and owning vulnerability. We're sick of everyone has got it right, because there is no such thing. And I keep saying to parents, good enough. I was only good enough, and my boys will tell me all the mistakes I made. And I own them, because in every moment that can happen to you.
So when you do show that vulnerability, how impactful is that for a young person?
It's absolutely enormous, because one of the things, and this comes from even in my classrooms, I wanted to create classroom environments that were safe for everyone, not just the bright kids and the confident kids. I wanted it to be safe for the shy kids, the neurodivergent kids, the Aboriginal children, or the ones from a different culture, or those who just struggle in those spaces. And I really started that. It wasn't what I was taught at uni, but I wanted you to know that in my classrooms, I had your back and everybody mattered to me. And also at the end of a year, I just promised you're going to be better. And I'm looking at you as a whole human sitting on that seat, not just a brain that I need to test. And, you know, they did just respond to this. Nobody's ever walked in and said, just don't want to learn to love you. Like, this is high school, right? Yeah, but it's amazing.
So that segues to my next question. And I know this is a big, broad question, but from your observation of all that you have seen over the years, when you look at young people today, what is your top concern, if you could highlight one or a couple?
Okay, I couldn't do just the one, but what I'm seeing today is that the world around our children has changed, not what children need. And so from the get-go, I think we've got far too much pressure on children, far too much pressure on parents. The life has been busy, and I think there's been some gifts from COVID. We kind of paused and went, oh, this isn't so bad, not going so fast. Secondly, our school system has changed in a way that's not helpful. Just endless testing, endless accountability, which has sucked out a lot of joy.
For teachers,
particularly, and for kids. I don't think they're growing up with a love of learning. Then on top of that, we have the digital world. And we know there's incredible pluses in that world. But what I'm seeing is a disconnect. I call it a form of digital abandonment, that our parents don't eyeball to eyeball as much. You go out to dinner and, you know, as a grandparent, I can't talk to them if they're all on screens, doing that to keep them quiet. The digital world also has exposed our kids to things that kids should not see or experience. So we have a heightened level of anxiety in children, a heightened level of mental illness among our teens. And I believe we've lost a sense of village, that we all care for each other's kids because we're all locked in our houses. And so I think my biggest concern is that we're not raising resilient children emotionally, socially and physically. And the things that you do to raise that aren't complex. and we need to get them back outside, playing in a real world with real kids, falling over, grazing their needs, not putting endless photos up online of the perfect child.
With regards to, and I want to, we obviously will talk about social media, but with regards to boys, you talk about boys needing tribes. Just elaborate on that. How do you create tribes and why are they important?
It's this really interesting thing about boys in that as they get into the puberty years, you know, they go a little bit unpleasant. And a lot of it's to do with the brain pruning. They get even more forgetful and they get even more disorganised, and some of them lose the capacity to speak articulately, and they start feeling really grumpy and stressed and like, oh, I'm just stupid. And when they do that, they often really dump that into the home space, and usually mum kind of cops it. But they really start questioning who they are and their identity. So when we have around boys, significant adults who have either been real biological family, or the swimming coach from when they were little, or the soccer coach, or the music teacher, as long as they still keep shining a light into that space while they're yucky, they tend to get through it a bit better than those who have no tribe. And I'll share a quick story of a boy that was boarding. Sometimes boys struggle with boarding because they have, it's not homesickness, it's massive grief. They're grieving for their bedroom and their mum's cooking and the family dog and the motorbike and the
familiarity.
Absolutely everything. So multiple grieving causes them massive stress. And this boy, I'd worked with him, and when he went home for Easter, he went down to the newsagents in their very small country town. And the newsagent said, Gasco, good to see you. I heard you did quite well in the swimming and it's great to see this. And when he walked home, he burst into tears because they hadn't forgotten him. And he felt he was still being held from a distance. And that's something girls kind of get, but sometimes our boys just feel, I've been separated and no one cares. So the tribe is really important. And often it's the parents of the friends and mates, because they do get sick of mum nagging because they do stink and they haven't washed their hair and they've put the empty milk carton in the fridge for the 15th time. And so when somebody else says to them, and I had our house was just full of boys, and I'd say to a boy, you know, I'm just going to run you home up, you know, in a moment, but gee whiz, I think you need some, you know, deodorant. You really are really smelly at the moment. They go, yeah, no worries, and just do it because I'm not mum or not dad. So that's what a kind of tribe. We keep sending the same messages that mum and dad would be saying, but they often hear them. And it's that place that says, you still care for me, even though I'm awful at the moment. That's called, you know, that really unconditional support.
And what that anecdote that you just shared illustrates to me is, and we do hear this quite often, boys aren't given permission to be emotional. It seems that the only acceptable emotion adolescent boys are allowed to feel is anger.
Yep.
How do we reverse that?
Oh, look, it's a biggie. And I think we're definitely making some changes. But it's the social conditioning is so profound for our children, you know, and that's kind of why I ended up writing Girlhood as well, because I keep seeing little girls already starting to be quiet and nice. And people please. Well, boys are going, okay, so it's not as okay. And I hear it sometimes, not as often now, but early childhood educators will just go, come on, mate, move on, stop snivelling. But we don't say that to a girl. So that messaging shapes that journey. Now, I was really blessed because I was an English teacher. So I could work with their hearts. And there were times I'd choose a short story that I know would land deeply. And there would be tears. And so because my classroom was safe, they didn't have to wipe those away. And so sometimes it's, where is there somewhere else that someone lets them be okay with that? And we're working hard, Georgie, in that space, but the conditioning is still really quite strong around owning vulnerability, because that's not a manly thing either. And that's one of the reasons I believe our suicide rates for young boys and young lads is just horrendously far too high, because when they struggle and they feel vulnerable, they can not feel they can turn to help seeking, you know, and that's the worry.
My observation is that boys are considerably less resilient than girls of the same age. And I don't think we possibly realise that and factor that in enough.
I totally agree with you. Like I said, that messaging that said boys are tough and girls aren't is totally the reverse in lots of ways. Boys might have physical strength with their muscles, but emotionally, way more fragile. Fragile early and fragile in the adolescent window.
What are your thoughts on the role of the mother in that instance? Because there is some messaging that mothers need to step back and, you know, I know there's this common phrase of crossing the bridge to adolescence and telling mothers to get off the bridge and get out of the way. Can you tell me what your thoughts are on that sort of messaging?
Oh, look, I'm a huge fan of Celia Lashley's work, and her and I met at some time. She dropped a lot of F-bombs in her work. But
we should mention Celia wrote the book He'll Be Okay.
He'll Be Okay.
And
yep.
She was a former prison
Absolutely.
Guard, wasn't she?
And what motivated her work was all these boys that were in prison that were just a bit thick. And also...
And had made stupid decisions.
Made stupid decisions. And, I mean, we know that still happens because in adolescence they're wired to take more risks. There's no gamma, which is the impulse inhibiting amino acid, which helps them stop that, which is another reason why they'll do the same dumb
impulsive
thing three or four times, and you'll be just that frustrated. The brain's not helping them in that moment. So one of the things that, and I found this was really interesting, that I had some students in one of the most difficult schools I ever taught in. I was given the at-risk students, and they were all criminal records. They were all of them. There's only about 18. And the principal just said to me, keep the mongrels in the classroom, which really riled me up until I met them and thought, yes, okay, so I've got to work with this. And what it was there was nowhere safe, right, for them to figure out how this thing life worked. And not all of them came from abuse. Some of them came from recent migrants who didn't speak English. And so they were kind of floundering without that space. And what we noticed was, I was a safe female, and they would sometimes come to me after class and ask me how would I do this and what does that mean? And I felt suddenly there is a space still. And then what I did in the research for the From Boys to Men book was I asked men, nearly 2,000 men over 30, hopefully with a prefrontal cortex, who was the most significant person who helped you during this really bumpy ride to adulthood? And nearly 60% said their mum. And so while Celia's message is very much get off the bridge, this is where they need to be with guys, they definitely need to have men there and good men and men who turn up without criticism and shaming and all that sort of stuff. But what they also need is the presence of females and mother figures who can hold that sense of you can fall on me when it gets really bad. You know, I'm gonna still pick you up. But there's a line where boys will tell you you're too close, mum, back off. So when I was dealing with a lot of really angry boys in the home environment, they said mum needs to back off. And what they meant is they didn't mean they didn't love her, but she needs to stop asking the endless questions you asked of a primary school boy. You need to stop going in and reminding him on stuff that you would with a primary school boy. You need to stop asking what he thinks and where he's going and has he done his homework. Because every time you do that, you irritate him. So it's about them stepping to work out, okay, I'm not going to remind you about your lunchbox. I'm not going to remind you about your homework. And if you get busted at school, then that's the consequence. If you get hungry, that's your consequence. So it's an interesting little navigation of stepping back but still being there. And for me, you know, I had four of them. And I remember one of my most volatile ones gave me a serve after school. And because he didn't get his own way for something. And so what I would do, and this is a really deceptively powerful thing to do with a boy who doesn't deserve it, is about 20 minutes later, I'd go down and knock on his door and I'll remind you all, do not open the door too quickly. And then I would pop in a cup of Milo and a homemade Bicky and shove the dog in and close the door.
Yeah.
And I would walk away because I needed him to know that we were still okay.
Yeah.
Because I know that those boys who've done that to their mum aren't feeling good about it.
Yeah.
And apologising, that's another whole challenge because it's like a weakness sometimes in the man code. So when we want to go in and say, that's disrespectful, you need to apologise, you've made him feel twice as bad about who he is in that moment. And often when you've done that, they'll come back about an hour or two later and go, sorry, mum.
It's so true. It is so true.
Kindness is a powerful, powerful, most beautiful weapon you've got. And good food.
And how – what I have witnessed with having a dog in the house is just mind-blowing. Yeah. The number of times I've seen a six-foot-two son curled up lying holding the dog, I can't explain.
Because you know what dogs do, Georgie? They are consistently loving. They never roll their eyes, go – they never kind of look disappointed, but that's the same for us. Don't we need that in our lives as well? That there's always that dog's going to love me, even if I have just yelled at this and done that. So I think, you know, I love good dogs in houses.
Dogs are a necessity. Let's talk about girls. Of course, their needs are different as they cross that bridge that we talked about. What are your observations there in terms of what their biggest challenges are? And I guess this is all associated with social media, the advent of social media.
I think the first thing we need to recognise is, yes, there is, in atypical girls and boys, very different things going on in adolescence. Girls will go into it earlier. So by that 14-year-old age group where boys are floundering around, oh, just like Neanderthal apes in so many ways and people think an alien stolen your son, the girls are already coming out into this really mindful, aware space. They're actually thinking they'd like a boyfriend who's 2 years older. You know, they've got their stuff sorted. So one of the things that's different for them both, which causes the problems that social media does, is the dynamics of friendships are way more complex. And girls have, from a very early age, are working out how to form alliances and how to manipulate, and often not always kindly. So what happens is the perfect storm later is we know that the three things that really are important for adolescence is who am I? And that's one of the biggest challenges that I think has been a negative, and we now know that from the stats that particularly Instagram, where girls are putting pictures of themselves up, which they've altered 15 times with 14 different filters. Mm. If they don't get enough likes, their day is just awful, right? And the need to be approved, that's a big part of girl friendships and also girls' self-worth. Boys give themselves self-worth because they go, gee, I did good. Mm. But us girls are going, I wonder if they liked it. And even my granddaughter, who's just five, at book week the other week when I was there, she came out with the costume on and said, I don't know if the others will like this. So what happens in the high school window is with social media, they are still doing the same dynamics they would do in a real space of how do I form alliances and keep friends. And if your little group, one of them's decided to be a little, what we call, you know, aggressive emotionally or whatever.
Often passive aggressive.
Yep, relational aggression is name calling, exclusions, all those sorts. They're starting to do that, but you want to stay in that group. Then there's a part of you that will sometimes do that, you know, and it's not what they want to do. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges is that social media has actually invited the nastiness to have a platform of power and trolling, and a lot of schools, this is what they spend half their life doing, is undoing the damage. But we know that for girls, we don't forget stuff. This is one of the things I worked out in all that research, is that we remember every painful moment. So when you have a cluster of those over a few weeks, it really impacts your mental health. And not only that, it impacts your capacity to learn in a classroom. It impacts how you behave around home. It's just awful. So we're finding our girls statistically are struggling at much higher rates of stress and anxiety than boys. And one of the researchers that I found said that girls basically are pretty cruisy until about eight. And at eight, the adrenal androgens, which are these deep hormonal changes, start happening with puberty. And basically girls' self-esteem starts falling off a cliff, particularly around that 12 to 14 window. And it is the window where the most nastiness will occur for teen girls. Mm. And then gradually as the prefrontal grows a little bit more myelin to let them think more deeply. So can you see there's a window? Mm. It's the window where often boys are slapping each other and wanting to jump on each other and call out rude things in class because they think they're funny.
Yep.
Our girls are going into a much darker manipulative space. And I know that sounds like it's awful, but that's exactly what the research shows us. And we need people to help them decode that, understand that, and make better choices.
And let's talk about that, because despite all that white noise, brought on by social media, we do have opportunities to empower them and to bathe them in reaffirmation and positivity, don't we?
Oh, totally. And really, there are now, consciously, girls, teenage girls, creating sites that are, you know, positive body affirming, who are collectively celebrating how, you know, girls are and doing the opposite.
Mm.
So, you know, like, I painted that dark picture because we know that if we're not aware and supporting and creating spaces. Now, everyone says it's great, just have loving parents. Well, there's a thing that happens in adolescence where they want to individuate and pull back from us. So what I found is far more valuable is, where are the significant adult allies who can be those coaches, those guides, those ones that just, your face lights up when you see them, that give them hope, because they are the things that transform absolutely all our teens' lives. So I was blessed with like a whole heap, because I was counselling. I became kind of the lighthouse for nearly everyone that came through my door, and some of them still are connected to me today, sending me photos of their babies.
Because wonderful.
When you have a lighthouse figure who can sit with you when you are in your darkest moment without judgment, with compassion, it is life-changing, and everyone needs them. We all have kind of hope we have friends that can do that. I've got a fantastic sister. But our teens, as they pull away from mum and dad in the search for identity, they need these lighthouse figures that as a teacher, there's a lot of teachers that are this for kids.
Yeah.
But they're also, you know, those figures I mentioned before. Sometimes it's the music teacher, or it's the auntie, the neighbour. Sometimes it's a grandparent. And I just keep saying to communities, the only way to rebuild a safe village is to make sure everybody knows they matter in the shaping and the caring of our kids, because that's exactly how Mother Nature intended it to be. They have to feel they belong, even after they've crashed your car and you've picked them up drunk from the party, or, you know, that they've done something bad online. They need to know you can still love them fiercely, because we've all been there.
Yeah. They matter.
They absolutely
matter. And that they're enough.
That's totally the big message. It's like, if you imagine there's a light on their chest that says, show me I matter. And so for me, it was those boys I taught who were illiterate. I wanted them to know they still mattered, that they had family who loved them, that there would be something they could do in life that makes the world a better place. That's the message a lighthouse gives. It says, you know, you're here. You're supposed to be here. And there's something in you that is going to help you. It might not be academic. It might not be sport. It might be because you're going to become an amazing environmental warrior. You might be an amazing carer of the elderly. But there's something in you that we know is there, and we're going to hold the space for you to find that so you can be that.
I just love that. And, of course, RAISE offers early intervention mentoring, as you know, in schools to help support young people through those formative years when they need to hear that key message, you matter. I know we have a lot of would-be mentors listening to this podcast who might feel possibly unqualified or inadequate to take on that role as a lighthouse, as you call it. What would you say to them? Because I feel that everyone has the potential to be a lighthouse.
Totally. And I really understand that, because early on in my teaching, I'd only done my teaching training, no counselling. And I remember one day I was waiting, I was on bus duty, and the bus was a bit late, and I noticed a girl leaning against a pole, and I looked and thought, she's not in a good space. So I walked over near her, and I said, why don't we sit on the steps till the bus comes? And I just chatted for a bit, like, you know, to make her a little bit rapport building. And we just had a chat. We didn't really dive into enormous deep stuff, but I told her how I really struggled. I was a moody, dark teenager. You know, I'd had a difficult relationship with my mum, and it was tough at times. But I said, every now and then I found some light people that were great. I had a great auntie. And anyway, and I never thought any more of it. And then in year 12, she was in year 8 at the time, in year 12 she found me. And she came to tell me that that was the day she had actually decided to end her life.
Oh.
And the fact that you took the time to sit next to me and just chat to me like I mattered, obviously I bawled my eyes out, but I needed to hear that, because I didn't sit next to her as a counsellor or a teacher. I sat next to her as a caring human who identified that someone was struggling, just like I used to. Mm-hmm. And so it is, it's about holding a space that has no judgment. We don't preach, we don't tell them, we just, what do you think? What do you reckon would be a great idea? What are your thoughts around coming from a different place? Have you thought of, right, there's a way we just, but basically they just need to be heard.
And the bottom line is there isn't a single person walking this earth who can't, who doesn't qualify as someone who can do exactly what you did on that
Absolutely
day.
Absolutely right.
And of course there's so much to be gained from it for the mentor. Mm. It's not just about the mentee, it's about what it can do for the mentor.
Yeah, we're biologically wired that when we help someone else, we actually give ourselves a really big kick of dopamine. There's no question. And that's really why I eventually decided, oh, look, I'm going to walk away from teaching English because anyone can teach how to write paragraphs. But I've got this ability to listen and make sense and support these people. So I went off and that's what I did for 5 or 6 years full time. And that's where I got my stories that drives my work as well, right from little children. And it was girls, mainly girls, but I saw boys. And when boys came in, they were dragged in because they were, you know, they were mums wanted them to be fixed and they won't talk to me. And it was interesting that there's a different way of communicating to boys and girls. And usually it was, how do you build that rapport at the beginning? So quite often I'd say something like, oh, my God, did you see the skid marks just where you come into my office? And they look, because skid marks, there's a few. Yeah. I said, you've been dragged, haven't you? And he's gone, yeah. And I'm going, okay. So these are the five things that usually boys get dragged here for. Which is yours? And they go, yeah, those three there are mine, right?
Yeah.
And then at the end of it, they haven't stopped talking. They go to leave. Mum's paid the bill. And he's asked for another appointment, you know. And they think I just feed them full of chocolate.
Yeah.
But I am good at communicating with boys particularly. I'm working on my girls because I, you know, and then that's a space. We need to learn just to be really good listeners. It doesn't matter where we are in life, sitting on a train, even if you can get someone's head out of their phone for a moment, you know, we just really want to be seen and heard because that's the way we feel we belong.
Yeah. And I love the way you incorporate humour into it because I think that is something, that is the great leveller.
There's no question that I owe my dad that blessing, is that's really the way that I connected so often with my own sons was, you know, because they didn't want me as a counsellor, you know, like, well don't you do that on me, Mum. And when they weren't talking to me and they were having a hard space, you know, there were times I'd just tread on their foot or sit on them on the couch accidentally or, you know, I have to admit that fart, yeah. You know, that I walk past and fart. And because as soon as I lighten it a bit,
yeah,
everything's a bit easier, isn't it?
Always. And I must say, I've taken up your advice about just going and sitting on them.
Yeah, just sit right on. They go, what are you doing? I don't know.
And it's a way of getting a cuddle in, totally. which of course, deep down they adore. Yeah.
Totally.
Maggie, you are just, as I say, the font of common sense and knowledge and experience, and your love of sharing this positive messaging is so uplifting and incredibly helpful to so many people. It's always such a delight to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And please, everybody, step up and be a lighthouse for someone young at the moment.
Well said. Well said.